This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 77 to 78 of chapter Al-Hajj from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizgar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. يا أيها الذين آمنوا اركعوا واسجدوا واعبدوا ربكم وافعلوا الخير لعلكم تفلحون. يا أيها الذين آمنوا اركعوا واسجدوا واعبدوا ربكم وافعلوا الخير لعلكم تفلحون. وجاهدوا في الله حق جهاده هو اجتباكم وما جعل عليكم في الدين من حرج ملة أبيكم إبراهيم وسماكم المسلمين من قبل وفي هذا ليكون الرسول شهيدا عليكم وتكونوا شهداء على الناس وسماكم المسلمين من قبل وفي هذا ليكون الرسول شهيدا عليكم وتكونوا شهداء على الناس فأقيموا الصلاة وآتوا الزكاة واعتصموا بالله هو مولاكم فنعم المولى ونعم النصير. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. O you who believe, bow down and prostrate yourselves and serve your Lord and do good that you may succeed.
and strive hard in the way of Allah, such striving as is due to Him. He has chosen you and has not laid upon you any hardship in religion. The faith of your father Ibrahim, he named you Muslims before, and in this, that the apostle may be a bearer of witness to you, and you may be bearers of witness to the people. Therefore, keep up prayer and pay the poor rate, and hold fast by Allah. He is your guardian. How excellent the guardian, and how excellent the helper.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Iran accuses the U.S. and its Western allies of being behind the recent riots, saying...
Says the Western countries have provoked the recent riots in Iran have set conditions to withdraw their support for the unrest. Hundreds of workers at a UK housing charity launch a two-week strike, joining the growing number of private and public sector staff staging walkouts. And the U.S. state of North Carolina declares a curfew and schools remain closed after power outages caused by vandalism. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Since the beginning of the recent riots in Iran, the country's officials have repeatedly blamed certain Western countries for inciting and fueling the violence. Now, a security source says those Western countries have set out no less than four conditions for renouncing their support for the rioters. The source told Iran's Al Alam news network that the Western countries have demanded that Iran unconditionally injects its oil and gas into the global energy market in the current critical climate, agreeing to Western positions in the standoff over Iran's nuclear program was another term specified, and the two other conditions entailed Iran going along with Saudi Arabia on regional issues and not cooperating with Russia. The riots in Iran broke out after the death of a young woman called Mahsa Amini in September. She collapsed at a police station in Tehran and died at a hospital days later. Iran says more than 200 people, including security forces, innocent people, as well as rioters, have been killed in the unrest. following reports of a three-day strike by shopkeepers in Tehran and other cities across Iran, our team took a tour around the Iranian capital to investigate the matter. Here's a report by Yusuf Chaladi.
Planned nationwide strikes were supposed to start on Monday across Iran, based on social media posts that have been calling for business owners to roll down their shutters for 3 days. A quick stroll on the streets of Tehran, however, shows that all the fuss is limited to the virtual world.
Life goes on as normal here in this district. I think social media exaggerates the problems. From what I saw today, no one is paying attention to the calls for a strike.
The country has been gripped by street violence for 10 weeks now, with anti-government protests claiming the lives of civilians and security forces. Now the same protesters have called for a three-day strike, marking the anniversary of the National Student Day in the country.
Student Day belongs to the Islamic Revolution and is a manifestation of the repression exercised by the former Pahlavi regime against our people. So it can't be used to protest against the Islamic establishment. I'm certain that all of the plots hatched to cause trouble to our country are doomed to failure.
Videos circulating on social media show some shops in Tehran's Grand Bazaar closed. However, people say some shopkeepers have closed their shops in fear of vandalism by protesters.
Everyone is busy with their businesses today. There are some shops which have been closed, but the majority of them fear possible damage by protesters.
The Islamic Republic says what's happening on social media is not a true reflection of what's actually going on the ground. Over the past days, Iranian officials have been calling for a national dialogue to, quote, stop the enemy from fishing in troubled waters. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
For the first time in Iran and West Asia, organs have been harvested from three donors after they were declared deceased, helping save the lives of patients in need. The operation was carried out by a knowledge-based company. It entailed harvesting a kidney, liver, pancreas, intestines, and a heart valve. The procedure has been approved by the Middle East Society for Organ Transplantation. Organ harvesting and transplants from patients post-cardiac or brain death have been performed for years in Iran, but this is the first time a post-mortem organ donation procedure is carried out in the country and in West Asia.
I'm the sole breadwinner of my 8-member family. Sometimes I can put food on the table, but sometimes we go to bed hungry. The situation is so difficult that sometimes we can't even buy ourselves some oil. Having heating or other necessities is becoming almost impossible.
The Gallup survey also reveals that the unpopularity of the American leadership has risen to a record 84% among Afghans. Meanwhile, the poll shows more and more Afghans are looking favorably towards Iran, as the neighboring country's popularity is on the rise. Afghanistan is rated as the most suffering and unhappiest country in the world. Many here believe the current situation is a direct result of the U.S. occupation and war in the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Let's turn to the U.K. now, where hundreds of workers at a housing charity have launched an unprecedented two-week strike, joining other walkouts in the private and public sectors. More than 600 workers at the charity began industrial action in what their union described as a bitter dispute over pay. Nurses, teachers, lawyers, train and dock workers are among groups that have gone on strike. They're angry at the cost of living crisis and insufficient pay that does not keep up with inflation. Just last week, the National Union of Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers said more than 40,000 workers will stage strikes in December and January, signaling major Christmas disruptions. The UK government is now considering using military's help to fill in for striking workers ahead of key walkouts by nurses and ambulance staff. And the walkouts and their impacts on the British economy were the topic earlier of our news review program. Here it is.
To To discuss that further, we're joined by Robert Carter, our correspondent in London, and also Tony Gosling, historian and journalist, joining us live from Bristol. Let's begin with our correspondent. Robert, give us an update on this most recent strike and, of course, the situation that Britain has been in over the past couple of months. We've been covering news of different industrial action over the past couple of months.
Sure. Well, of course, as you rightly mentioned, there's been many major strike actions taking place this year, and there's already plans being made to continue those actions well into next year as of January. So, of course, there are everything ranging from rail strikes on the horizon, there's postal strikes, strikes regarding the NHS, strikes regarding ambulance drivers, so really important sectors. And what really they're aiming to do is cause significant pressure for the government in the lead up to the Christmas holiday. So that's a time when, of course, packages will be flying up and down the country, letters, as well as a real need for healthcare and different public services. Transport services will be in very much in high demand during that period as well. And of course, this is very unwelcome news for the government, which is trying to convince the general public to digest many cuts in public spending and that type of thing. Now, shockingly enough, government minister has actually weighed into the row and has basically urged anyone considering going on strike going forward not to do so because it will benefit Putin. So he's tried to make some kind of foreign policy geopolitical statement suggesting that if you go on strike, you're basically helping Putin, which, according to the British government, is a foreign enemy abroad. So this is a comment which was very badly received, caused major condemnation from bosses of several trade unions who accused the government of being basically deeply offensive in using those comments. So the situation seems to be getting worse, not better. And in the days and weeks to come, strike action is still very much on the cards and could escalate well into next year.
Okay, so Mr. Gosling, you just heard the update from our correspondent on the situation on the ground. And we've also had news that these workers that are on strike are not agreeing to just any kind of pay rise. In particular, the most recent one, a 4% pay rise, was not accepted because it did not meet the demands of those workers. Do you believe that the UK government is capable to meet their demands at all?
Well, I think it wouldn't be no problem for them to. And even though many of these sectors have been partially or fully privatised, the government is still in the driving seat when it comes to negotiating. This 4% offer to the rail workers, well, it's really an insult. And, you know, what we're looking at in the UK is between 10 and 15% inflation. The idea is, of course, that the rail workers want to keep their standard of living, so they want a similar pay rise. 4% is nothing like that. And so in a way, the government, what it's trying to do, using the press to bamboozle the public if possible, is to say, well, we've given them an offer, you know, but they've turned it down. And it's fascinating to look at Nadeem Zahawi, the chairman of the Conservative Party, who made these comments about the strikers being in some way collaborating with Putin and the Russians. What's happening, I mean, for example, Zahawi, take a look at him. He's part of something called the Pinay Circle, along with several other ministers, or past ministers in the British government, which is this very private, secretive club of far-right former intelligence executives. So this Le Cercle, they call it, is initially started by Pinay, who's a French collaborator with the Nazis in the Second World War. And these people are actually, I think, making policy and making these statements as provocations. And what they're doing is they're saying effectively that we are the enemies not just of Russia, but of our own people, because they must expect as politicians that their own people will want to maintain their standards of living. If they don't, then they're at war with their own people. So we're looking at various different crises here in the UK. We've got the climate crisis, where this zero carbon policy is actually making things worse, not better. We're also looking, obviously, we've had the COVID thing recently with the policies there, with the vaccines. in many ways making things worse than they were, so that the cure is better, worse than the disease. And now this economic crisis, with the Russian sanctions massively increasing inflation in Britain and making things worse for the Brits. So you do have to wonder, is this deliberate? All these so-called solutions worse, making things worse. And that's why we've got the strikes, I think, and it's quite clear that even university staff, etc., now going on strike, that these public sector workers are going to maintain their living standards come what may, and the government, really for big business and the World Economic Forum, the globalists, is taking them on in order to try and break the union. So it's going to be a big battle.
Thank you very much. Tony Gosling, historian and journalist, joining us live from Bristol, and our very own Robert Carter, live from London. Thanks for sharing your thoughts and views with us on this edition of the News Review.
Tens of thousands of people are without electricity in the U.S. state of North Carolina after two power substations came under gunfire. A state of emergency has been announced in Moore County. Schools are closed and curfews imposed until authorities fix issues caused by what they're calling an intentional and targeted crime. County Sheriff Ronnie Fields says that the FBI is investigating the matter.
We're looking at all avenues. That's the reason I've got the professionals, the federal folks. They deal with the domestic terrorism more than locals. So they're on board, and they're working with us to determine exactly who done this. Now, I can say this. This individual that done this, it was targeting. It wasn't random. They pulled up, and somebody did, and opened fire on the substation. And same thing at the other one. It was a gate, and they went through the gate and got to the substation and shot it as well.
Local newspaper also reports heavy damage to the infrastructure. Around 36,000 electric customers in the county were left without power Sunday evening. The energy company responsible for power in the county has warned customers to brace for potential outages that could last for days. Tensions are running high between the U.S. and China as the two have been flexing military muscles amid a tug of war over international dominance. Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin says China has both the will and power to reshape the U.S.-dominated international order. He warned, however, that Washington will not let that happen.
U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin has said the country is building a more lethal force posture in the Indo-Pacific as part of efforts to make sure China doesn't dominate the region the way it intends to. Addressing the Reagan National Defense Forum, Austin said China is the only country with both the will and increasingly the power to reshape its region and the international order. He added that Washington will not let that happen. The Pentagon chief added that the next few years will set the terms of the U.S. competition with the People's Republic of China, saying Beijing will shape the future of security in Europe. Referring to the modernization of the country's military force, he said that the U.S. is aligning its budget as never before to China challenge.
We're aligning our budget as never before to the China challenge. We're making the department's largest investment ever in R&D. And forging stronger capabilities. And we're modernizing training and equipping the U.S. military contingencies in the Indo-Pacific.
He went on to say one of the meanings of deterrence is sea power, announcing that the Pentagon is investing in the new construction of 9 battle force ships and Columbia-class ballistic missile submarines. Last month, one of Washington's fourth-class nuclear-powered carriers made its first transit to Europe. Austin also noted that the Pentagon is concerned about Russia and remains committed to arming Ukraine while avoiding escalating that conflict into a U.S. war with Moscow. However, he said between the two nuclear power threats, China remains the greater risk. The Pentagon has also unveiled B-21 Raider, its first new strategic bomber in more than 30 years.
The B-21 Raider is the first strategic bomber in more than three decades. It is a testament to America's enduring advantages in ingenuity and innovation. And it's proof of the department's long-term commitment to building advanced capabilities that will fortify America's ability to deter aggression today and into the future.
The nuclear-capable Batwing plane is being designed to best the quickly growing cyber, space, and nuclear capabilities of Beijing. The bomber is part of a major nuclear triad overhaul underway that the Congressional Budget Office has estimated will cost $1.2 trillion through 2046. It includes the Raider serving as the backbone of the future airleg of the triad, but it also requires modernizing the nation's silo-launched nuclear intercontinental ballistic missiles and its nuclear submarine fleet. The comments by Austin amount to a new warning shot to President Xi Jinping, even as the U.S. looks to establish what it calls guardrails and keep tension with China from spiraling out of control.
Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the Name of Allah, the Best of the Names. In the Name of Allah, of earth and heaven. I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
In the limelight.
A new analysis finds that the U.S. war in Somalia was waged with no clear legal basis. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Intercept wrote, "The United States has fought more than a dozen secret wars over the last two decades, according to a new report from Brennan Center for Justice at New York University's School of Law. Through a combination of ground combat, air strikes, and operations by U.S. proxy forces, these conflicts have ranged from Africa to the West Asia region, to Central Asia, often completely unknown to the American people and with minimal congressional oversight. This proliferation of secret war is a relatively recent phenomenon, and it is undemocratic and dangerous," wrote Catherine Young, a Bright Counsel in the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program. "The conduct of undisclosed hostilities in unreported countries contravenes our constitutional design. It invites military escalation that is unforeseeable to the public, to Congress, and even to the diplomats charged with managing U.S. foreign relations," she added. "These clandestine conflicts have been enabled by 2001 authorization for use of military force enacted in the wake of September 11 attacks, as well as the covert action statute, which allows secret, unattributed operations primarily conducted by the CIA." The United States has also relied on a set of obscure security cooperation authorities that The Intercept has previously investigated, including an expose earlier this year that revealed the existence of unreported U.S. counterterrorism efforts in Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, and Yemen. A Bright document, so-called 127E programs, known by their legal designation in those countries, and 12 others, including Afghanistan, Cameroon, Iraq, Kenya, Libya, Mali, Mauritania, Niger, Nigeria, Somalia, and Tunisia, as well as a country in the Asia-Pacific region that has not yet been publicly identified. The 127E authority, which allows U.S. commandos to employ local surrogates on U.S.-directed missions targeting U.S. enemies to achieve U.S. aims, is just one of the three low-profile efforts analyzed in the Brennan Center report. Another 10 U.S. Code 333, often referred to as the Global Train and Equip Authority, allows the Pentagon to provide training and gear to foreign forces anywhere in the world. The FAR Mercury 1202 authority allows the Defense Department to offer support to foreign surrogates taking part in irregular warfare aimed at near-peer competitors like China and Russia. The report released recently offers the most complete analysis yet of the legal underpinnings, congressional confusion, and a Pentagon obfuscation surrounding these efforts, and explains how and why the Defense Department has been able to conduct under-the-table conflicts for the last 20 years. The Brennan Center's report underscores the need to shine a light on the defense activities that have been cloaked in secrecy for too long. At the bare minimum, the public and Congress need to know where and why we are sending our service members into harm's way. Representative Sarah Jacobs of California, a member of the House Armed Services Committee, told The Intercept, adding, "I hope this report strengthens the urgency of Congress taking back its war powers, eliminating existing loopholes in security operations programs, and ensuring our strategies match our values, goals, and commitment to our service members." Congress's understanding of U.S. warmaking is often no better than the public record, writes Ebright, adding, "The Departments of Defense diplomatic counterparts in the Department of State also struggle to understand and gain insight into the reach of U.S. hostilities. Where congressional oversight falters, so too does oversight within the executive branch." Ebright's analysis is particularly illuminating in the case of Somalia, where the United States developed two key proxy forces, the Donop Brigade and the Puntland Security Force. The CIA began building the Puntland Security Force in 2002 to battle the Al-Qaeda-affiliated Al-Shabaab and later the State in Somalia, or ISS. The force was transferred to U.S. military control around 2012 and went on to fight alongside U.S. Special Operations Forces for a decade. In Puntland, we built that capability, training them at the tactical level and in how to support themselves and follow a good counterinsurgency strategy against Al-Shabaab. Don Bulldog, the former chief of Special Operations Command Africa and now the Republican candidate for Senate in New Hampshire, told The Intercept in a 2019 interview. Ebright notes that the proxy fighters were largely independent of the Somali government, despite being an elite armed brigade and one of Somalia's most capable special operations units. And their relationship with U.S. forces was long kept secret, with U.S. officials disavowing the presence of military advisors in Somalia until 2014. More troubling, the analysis suggests that for a significant period of time, there was no clear legal basis for U.S. military to fight alongside and direct these forces. The Obama administration designated Al-Shabaab an associated force of Al-Qaeda and thus a legitimate target under 2001 AUMF in 2016. That administration did the same for the ISS in 2014, but ISS has never been publicly identified as an ISIS-associated force by any administration. This means that the Pentagon developed and fought alongside the Puntland Security Force from 2012 and the Donop Brigade from 2011. Under the 127E and 333 Security Cooperation Authorities, before the AUMF was judged to authorize hostilities against Al-Shabaab and ISIS, much less ISS. The Department of Defense is unequivocal that it does not treat 333 and 127E as authorizations for use of military force. The reality is not so clear, writes Ebright. After all, U.S. forces have used these authorities to create control and at times engage in combat alongside groups like the Puntland Security Force and Donop Brigade. Mm-hmm. over the last 20 years, presidents have consistently claimed broad rights to act in self-defense, not only of U.S. forces, but also for partners like the Puntland Security Force and Donna Brigade, which Ebright notes potentially allows the U.S. to fight remote adversaries in the absence of any congressional authorization. Representative Jacobs said it was difficult to assure the military community in her San Diego district that we are doing everything we can to keep them safe when Congress has such little information, let alone oversight over when, where, and how we are using military force. Attempts to avoid scrutiny from Congress and Congress's own abdication of war powers is central to how we ended up in forever wars, the spike in civilian casualties, and failed strategies that waste taxpayer dollars and the fuel very conflicts they are trying to solve. The report offers suggestions for improving congressional and public oversight, enforcing the balance of war powers within the government, and preventing hostilities unauthorized by Congress. Ebright writes, repealing 333, 127E, and 1202 would return the balance of power to where it stood before, the so-called War on Terror. Forcing the Pentagon to convince Congress that building foreign proxies abroad is in the United States' national security interest. This is critical given that working by, with, and through foreign surrogates and allies is key to the Pentagon's global vision. According to the Biden administration's recently released National Security Strategy and National Defense Strategy, both of those documents underscore that the DoD views security cooperation as the future of its approach, Ebright told Intercept, adding, meanwhile, on Capitol Hill and in the broader public, we don't have conversations about what this means, to the detriment of voters understanding where we are at war and how this is going to affect military involvement and entrenchment abroad.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In today's programme, we'll examine the relationship between Germany's political establishment and the Zionist regime. This relationship extends to Die Linke, that was founded in 2007 as a left-wing alternative to Germany's SPD. But Die Linke's leadership has been very hostile to the concept of justice for the Palestinian people. Rather than being the radical left-wing alternative it claimed to be when it was established, is Die Linke more concerned with maintaining the political status quo in Germany? I'll be talking to experts to find out after this special report by Latifa Abouchakra about how Germany has responded to the existence of the Zionist entity.
Germany is hostile territory for Palestine. It is the only place in the world outside Palestine where it is effectively illegal to wave a Palestinian flag. Earlier this year, the Berlin police banned all pro-Palestine demonstrations, including the Nakba commemoration and the protest at the Israeli murder of Shireen Abu Akleh. But why is Germany so backwards in its attitude to Palestine? The traditional response given is that the Germans are still trying to atone for the Nazi genocide against the Jews. But on the same day that riot police swooped on Neukölln and detained or stopped at least 170 people during the afternoon and evening of Nakba Day, by contrast, neo-Nazi admirers of Hitler's regime were free to meet and fly the German imperial flag. They were left unmolested. So something more fundamental is going on. Over the years, Zionist leaders have met with German counterparts, starting with the first Chancellor of West Germany after the 1939-45 war, Konrad Adenauer, and carrying on ever since. In 2008, Merkel addressed the Knesset, saying that Germany had a special responsibility for the security of Israel. In 2019, the German parliament voted to condemn BDS as anti-Semitic. Underlying this capture of German foreign and domestic policy by the Zionists is the influence of the US and the failure of denazification after the war. NATO was a means to contain both the Soviet Union and Germany in US interests. Declassified files show that the State Department intelligence saw NATO as a place to help West Germany satisfy its reasonable aspirations and contain any potential unreasonable ones. In addition, the CIA actively set up the intelligence service of West Germany, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, known as the BND. The CIA knew that the head of the agency general, Reinhard Gehlen, was a former Nazi and approved his appointment, even though he employed numerous former Nazis and known war criminals. He was, of course, a CIA operative. Gehlen made contact with Mossad in 1957, and in 1967, an ex-Nazi officer in Gehlen's group passed on information to Mossad on Syria and Egypt, enabling Israel to destroy a large part of the Egyptian and Syrian air forces with a preemptive strike. Gehlen also maintained a network of compliant journalists, as a trove of recently leaked files shows. A network of compliant scribblers and informants was set up in the editorial offices of Germany and deployed time and time again to directly influence politicians and policies. Put in the context of the significant number of paid CIA assets in the German media, as revealed by the writer Udo Ulf Kotten, it is no surprise that the German political system, intelligence, and media are united in their support for Israel's crimes.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. David's a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog, Spinwatch. Our guest expert today is Phil Bevan. Phil worked in the Leader of the Opposition's office under Jeremy Corbyn. He's researched the role of the German left, and he's written a number of articles about how the Labour Party and the left more generally in the UK have been subverted. Welcome to the show. David, let me start with you if I can. What more can you tell us about this character Gehlen, the Nazi intelligence chief, who ended up running the West German intelligence service?
It's a fascinating tale. So he's head of Nazi counterintelligence, well, you know, one of the key areas, and he's then recruited by the CIA immediately at the end of the war, and the CIA makes sure that he is then placed, his network of intelligence network is then placed into West Germany. He becomes the head of West German foreign intelligence. And he remains there. He dies peacefully in his bed in 1979, and he remains there for some considerable time. The only reason he has to leave the intelligence organization is because his deputy is discovered to be a Soviet spy. So we have an organization which is run in post-war West Germany, run by a Nazi. He's disavowed Nazism, but he goes straight from being a Nazi intelligence officer through to being a CIA asset and into German intelligence. Now, does this mean that the German intelligence organization for the post-war period was effectively run by the CIA? Well, it looks a little bit like that.
Interesting. I mean, Phil, this Galen was also recruited, I understand, by the CIA, wasn't he? And what do you think the significance of this is for understanding German politics?
I think it's very significant, actually, because, yes, he was recruited by the CIA. He was also paid by the CIA to do his work. And although he was not the head of the SS intelligence, and it was military intelligence that he was in charge of, privately, he maintained his anti-Semitic views. So he conducted his organization in line with those views as well. He also did hire former SS officers into positions within the German intelligence service. And just to be clear, it's not like this was really a new organization. What really happened is that the CIA employed Galen's existing organization that was in place under the Nazis to run the post-war German intelligence service, which was then called the Galen Organization, but became the BND. Effectively, they're the same thing. And we've seen the consequences of this in more recent years. There is still very close cooperation between the BND and the Americans. For example, in 2014, it was revealed that the US, the NSA, had been working with the BND to wiretap and listen in to German politicians. So the question is whether or not the BND is working primarily for the German state, or in fact the US state, and I don't think that has been properly addressed yet.
Right.
And also how much, right-wing, far-right politics still plays in the organisation and has historically played in the organisation. Yes.
Well, let me just go to David. I mean, one of the things that I think a lot of people would be interested in is why is it Germany is so pro-Zionist? I mean, do you think it's just simply guilt, or what other reason could there be?
Well, there's a sense in which the guilt's part of it, and it's the way in which the guilt becomes part of the political culture, which is important. But also, of course, the relationship with Americans and the very early on relationship between Galen and the Mossad. So he contacts the Mossad in the 50s. And they have a really quite close relationship from that point on. And that's part of the tale as well. So that in 1967, you have the intelligence about the Egyptian and the Syrian Air Force being passed through an ex-Nazi officer in Galen's organization to the Mossad, which allows the Israeli Defense Force to eliminate effectively the whole of the Egyptian and the Syrian Air Force, and thus allowing them much more easily to occupy the territories which they currently still occupy.
I mean, Phil, would you say it's a stretch to suggest that the BND was effectively an asset then of the CIA? I mean, if so, I mean, do you think it's still an asset of the CIA, in your opinion?
I think it was definitely an asset of the CIA originally. The Galen organization certainly was. And the BND, of course, grew out of that. And I think we shouldn't be drawing too much of a distinction between the two, because Galen also served as the head of the BND after it was renamed. So we are looking at really what is effectively the same organization. And as I mentioned before, there's been very close cooperation with the Americans over the years and into recent years. Whether or not it's currently an asset of the CIA, I don't know exactly, but like I said, there's evidence of the BND working against German politicians with authorities within the United States. So it's definitely a possibility, and it's something that we should be looking at very carefully. And I think this becomes increasingly relevant and important in light of the events over the war on Ukraine. For example, you've had Nord Stream 2 being blown up, and the German government has effectively shrugged its shoulders. And you know, we believe, so it's been reported, that actually those responsible for the destruction of Nord Stream 2 might be the Americans or the British. And so in which case, you've got German allies working against the interests of the German people, and possibly with the support of the German state, which is a bizarre situation to be in. And so we really do need to take this very seriously and look at it closely.
No, indeed. And talking of bizarre situations, David, I mean, Galen collaborated with the Mossad way back in the 1950s, didn't he?
He did. I mean, it's a bizarre situation, isn't it? I mean, you have the sort of vision of the BND, the Foreign Intelligence Service of the Germans, working against the interests of the German state, of the German people, and indeed, as Phil has been saying, you know, systematically through this period, spying not just on the left like we do in this country, but also on the right. Very, very many of the German leaders were spied upon by the German intelligence, and indeed, the CIA seemed to have been involved in some of this in terms of the channeling of money from the CIA into German foundations and to German journalists to pay for them to pump out propaganda which reflected US interests. Now, of course, the whole relationship with Zionism is pretty extraordinary. So we have this collaboration with Mossad, and what appears to be an ongoing collaboration with Mossad, so it's literally unthinkable for the foreign policy establishment of Germany to take any position which is in any way against the interests of the state of Israel.
Well, we're just going to have to pause there for a moment, just to have a look at the so-called left party in Germany and how it's been captured by the Zionists.
The German left party, known in Germany as Die Linke, has an appalling record on Palestine. Back in 2011, it was condemned by the BDS National Committee for patently false, intellectually and morally dishonest claims that equated calls for the boycott of Israeli goods with anti-Semitism. In 2019, when the German parliament overwhelmingly voted to condemn BDS as anti-Semitic, some Die Linke members voted for it, while others put a contending motion also opposing BDS. In a 2021 interview, Dietmar Bartsch, co-chair of the left parliamentary group in the Bundestag since 2015, revealed how a trip to Israel had changed a lot for him. His capture by Zionism was prompted by visiting Israeli cities that have been hit with rockets. He rejects BDS out of, quote, historical responsibility. One of the most farcical elements of the collapse of the notionally pro-Palestine Die Linke came in Toiletgate in 2014, when journalists David Sheen and Max Blumenthal were booked by Die Linke to give a talk and then banned by Die Linke leader Grigor Geisy. Video footage showed Geisy retreating to the toilet and locking himself in to evade questions, especially on smears of the journalist as anti-Semitic.
This is cowardly behavior. This is anti-democratic.
You're supporting the state-sanctioned racism. You're trying to make our lives worse. I'm going to go back to Israel, and I'm going to be slagged as an anti-Semite because you chose to spread the lies. I don't know what that means.
Later, undercover footage revealed that Toiletgate was set up by key Zionist activist Benjamin Weinthal. Weinthal says he serves as the eyes and ears in Europe of the Washington, D.C.-based Foundation for Defense of Democracies, an uber-Zionist think tank which directs Zionist regime links.
You have to be sort of an uber-tribalist counselor. You have to exaggerate to get these ideas across. Because they don't understand what contemporary anti-Semitism is, many of them.
Why is Die Linke particularly bad on BDS and Palestinian rights? Partly, it's the overwhelming subservience of German politics, both to the US and to Zionism and Israel. The extent to which Die Linke is designed to control the left rather than give expression to its demands was highlighted in a US State Department cable released by WikiLeaks, where the party's parliamentary leader, Gregor Geisy, told U.S. Ambassador Philip Murphy that the left's party's official policy on NATO, that it should be abolished and replaced by a new security alliance, including Russia, was only a ruse to avoid the more dangerous path of pulling Germany out of NATO. Die Linke today is in crisis, and even its own leaders have remarked on its inconsistent and contradictory approaches to many major issues, including the NATO proxy war in Ukraine. Die Linke is at best controlled opposition and is a clear obstacle to developing support for the liberation of Palestine in Germany.
David, this so-called Toiletgate affair seems a very strange event, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's Max Blumenthal, famously the editor of The Grey Zone in America, and David Sheen, who lives in the Zionist Entity quite a lot of the time. Yeah. And they were invited to give this talk, and the pressure was put on them, on Die Linke, and they were cancelled. And Gysi runs along and locks himself in the toilet. If you watch the full length of that video on YouTube, which is available if you have a look for it, he actually does it twice. He runs away and locks himself in the toilet twice. David Sheen's comments, I think, are the most appropriate, where he says, look, I live in Israel. I've got to go back there.
Yes.
And I'm now being accused of being anti-Semitic. This actually puts me in danger.
Indeed.
And of course, you know, it puts him in danger, anti-Zionist Jews in danger, certainly. But, you know, this is how Palestinians are kept in danger every single day.
Yes, extraordinary. Well, Phil, I wonder whether you could tell us about the think tank associated with Die Linke.
Well, associated with Die Linke is the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation. Now, to understand the role of this organisation, it's important to recognise that it's not unusual in terms of German government-funded foundations linked to political parties. That there's quite a few of these. So, the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation is a political foundation affiliated to Die Linke. It's one of several of similar foundations in Germany. But the interesting thing that got me intrigued with the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation is its role in funding British left-wing media. For example, Novara Media has received funding from the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation. And I know from the research that I've done that the money that comes from the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation is actually, for these kind of projects, is actually, it comes from the German Foreign Office and the German Foreign Development Office as well. So it's the Novara Media is effectively being funded by the German Foreign Office via the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation. And I think that's very interesting. I think it's also a bit concerning that we have supposedly, or what we'd like to believe, are independent left-wing media in this country actually receiving funds from the German state, which, as you've just outlined, is really terrible on issues like Palestinian rights. And actually, Novara Media's coverage of, for example, the anti-Semitism crisis, so-called anti-Semitism crisis within the Labour Party, really was not very good, and in many respects legitimised quite a lot of the kind of the underlying logic and principles of the new definition of anti-Semitism in the articles that it published.
Yeah. So are you saying then, Phil, that the role of the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation in funding platforms like Novara Media is kind of problematic then?
That's my opinion. I believe that because reading through the annual reports, it's available online. This is public documentation. There's nothing secretive about this. Is that the German Foreign Office obviously sets the kind of boundaries through which these funds, these grants are managed. And so there is government oversight over what they're used for. And with all kind of funding, you have to think that there's probably some form of restrictions attached with regards to what can be funded, what kind of organisations can be funded. And therefore, we are looking at the involvement of a foreign state in supporting particular points of views in this country, whether that's explicitly or implicitly through the funding relationship they have with them. Also of note, I think on this, and of concern, real concern, is that the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation and indeed Novara Media have both been platforms for journalist Paul Mason, who was revealed to have collaborated with British intelligence by the Grey Zone again, who were featured in that video. And so, again, Paul Mason is very pro-NATO.
Yeah.
And the fact that you've got somebody like him being platformed quite prominently by the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation and the media organisations that it funds.